Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we're going to be discussing unique marine conservation programs across the globe. I'm excited to have two leading women in marine conservation who got their start right here in Hawaii, and might I add, two dear friends. With us today is Melissa Walsh, who will be discussing marine conservation finance, and Petra McGowan, Reef Resilience Program Manager for the Nature Conservancy. First up is Melissa Walsh, a PhD candidate at the James Cook University in Townsville, Australia, who is working on marine conservation finance. No stranger to Hawaii or marine conservation, Melissa worked as the director for the Hawaii Fish Trust at Conservation International. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thanks, Carly. Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited to have you here and to hear what you've been doing in Australia for the last couple of years. So first off, what got you interested in going back to do your PhD and in marine conservation finance?
It's been a fun journey. When I was working in Hawaii at Conservation International, I realized that there was a lot of good work going on to save the reefs, and good engagement of communities and good science was happening. But I saw that there was an issue that there was never enough money to fund the community work and the science that needs to go on. And I recognized that there wasn't a lot of focus on how do we get better investment for coral reef management. So I decided that that was going to be my focus. And I made a hard decision to leave Hawaii and went to James Cook University in Australia because I was able to focus there in both the School of Business and in the Center of Excellence in Coral Reef Studies and bring together two very different fields of work in investment and coral reef management and bring them together in my PhD studies.
And I mean, this is something really unique. I would never, ever think to put business and marine conservation together, but it makes a lot of sense. I mean, these problems of funding are far and wide. It's not just an issue here in Hawaii. How was that bringing them together? Was this something that had been done before, or how did you go about the process of blending those two?
Well, certainly there are some really smart, good people around the world working in this area, but there I can count them on one hand. There's not a lot of us. Mm-hmm. But it is a global issue. We've estimated that the amount of money that's needed for conservation worldwide, the gap between the damage to the environment and the amount of money invested in the environment is on the order of $7 trillion a year. So there's this huge gap that we need to fill to do the work we need to do in the environment. And certainly everywhere that I've worked around the Pacific and now in Australia, I have the same challenges in Hawaii where government funding is there and it's so necessary and so appreciated, but by itself is just not enough to do the work that we need to do. So it is a global problem, but there's some solutions that we can borrow from other fields. And so learning lessons from business of how do we attract and maintain investors and how do we effectively use money better to get our outcomes. I've learned a lot from using those lessons of business and trying to apply those to improving how we do marine conservation.
It's absolutely fascinating. And do you have specific case studies that you've started to focus on with applying these principles, or is it more conceptual at this stage?
I've done a very broad conceptual global framework for how we can fund marine conservation better. And so I can speak a little bit about that global framework. And then I also picked out four case studies to drill into the details and show how that might work in real life. So I've tried to do a little bit of both, a little bit of theory and some also very practical on-the-ground solutions.
So tell us more about this global framework. What does that look like?
Well, it looks at why we have a funding gap for marine conservation in the first place and what we might do to fix that. And really the gap is there because people are damaging and using marine resources at a rate that's faster than we are maintaining or restoring them. and people are not always accountable for the damage they do to the environment. And that cost of damage, it's usually paid for by the public, by taxpayers, through government funding, and in some countries, including Hawaii, there's a lot of philanthropic or individual donation. But that's not enough. And some of the issues that I found were that when we are planning marine conservation projects, normally the concept of how are we going to fund those projects is left till the end. I did a global survey of 169 marine conservation practitioners around the world in 19 countries. And what I found is that over half of those practitioners didn't know how they were going to fund their program. They spent a lot of time getting the communities on board and getting the bits and pieces together for their programs, but didn't know where the money was going to come from to continue that work. And that is a really risky situation. So part of the solution is to integrate financial planning into conservation planning. So you're thinking about who are the investors and how are we going to fund things from day one.
That's so critical. And, you know, you hear a lot these days, especially in the United States, about government funding for science declining and going to a lot more private investment for that. Is that something that you looked at when you were doing this framework?
It's interesting. In Australia right now, sort of the opposite is the case, where I work a lot in the Great Barrier Reef. And in the Great Barrier Reef, there's a lot of political will right now for improving the conditions of the reef. It was one of the biggest issues in the last election that we had in Queensland. So there is a lot of government money, and there's a perception that that could be enough. And the reality is it's not enough. I think there will always be an ebb and flow in private money and public money. But to solve these issues, what we need are long-term strategies with diverse sources of funding. So that's another part of this framework, is figuring out which actions we need to fund that are better funded by public money. And some things always need government support, and there's no way they can go on without government support. For example, long-term monitoring of coral reefs. It's really hard to get anyone to pay for that other than government, so that's important. But there are places where private money can step in and leverage public funds. And so it's sort of doing a really longer than a political horizon, framing and planning for where is money going to come from and how do we make sure we're diversified so we're not putting all our eggs in one basket and over-relying on one source of funds, which could fall through.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, that's the number one rule of investment, right? You never put all your money in just one thing.
Exactly.
In case that falls through. Interesting. So you also said this framework applied to 4 case studies. Tell me a little bit about the case studies.
Sure. I really wanted to look across a spectrum of how you could get better investment for coral reefs. And I looked at different ways that businesses engage with marine conservation. And so on one end of the spectrum, I looked at companies that are damaging the reef and their primary focus is making a profit and they don't really care what happens to the coral reef. So we have to use legislation, policy. Sometimes the analogy of that carrot and stick is used, and this is the stick end of things. So I looked at something called offsets, which in the United States is sometimes called compensatory mitigation. But I did a case study in the Great Barrier Reef of how can we more effectively get offset funds from companies that are damaging the reef, and how do we ensure that we're getting a good ecological return on our investment for those funds. So that was sort of one end of things. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I researched something called impact investing. And impact investing is where businesses are created with the intention to do good by the community and the environment, and they use business models to get there. So instead of making a profit from damaging the environment, their whole intention and reason for being is to make the world a better place. But they don't rely on grants or donations. They do it through business models. And so I investigated how could we create impact investing businesses that resulted in marine conservation outcomes. So those were the two extremes, and then there were a few case studies in the middle.
Interesting. And so when you talk about the business models, I mean, a lot of that reminds me of ecotourism or marine tourism, where, you know, you have these businesses that are technically not impacting the reef or not are non-extractive resources and are profiting from the reef area and educating people. Did that play into your model at all?
Certainly. A lot of the existing examples of impact investing for marine conservation are in ecotourism. There are some examples in Indonesia and some other little examples around the world, but really they are focused on dive resorts that were set up to protect a certain marine species or habitat but used ecotourism to fund that. Mm-hmm. And while I think there's potential for those to grow, and I'm involved in a few projects around the world where we're trying to grow those models, I think there's so much more potential than that. In fisheries, for example, there are examples where when a fishery is harvested more sustainably, it is more profitable. But it costs money to change from where we are now to a more sustainable fishery. And there's money to be made for private investors once we are more sustainable. So there are examples in fisheries where you can make money and make the fishery more sustainable. And we're also looking at things like education, for example. Education is a really important part of marine conservation, building awareness and building behavior change. And often those types of programs are funded by donations. But sometimes there are ways where you can get the public, because they want to learn about the reefs, to pay for that. So it might seem like that's not a lot of money, but what it does is the public pays to go learn about the reefs, which frees up government dollars that then can be spent on more important priorities for the government.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, this seems like really great information that a lot of people could use. Have you had any inquiries or interest into the research that you've done to apply this on a local or national scale?
Yeah, certainly. There has been quite a lot of interest. And I've done a few trainings for coral reef managers in the Pacific Islands and in Australia to learn about how do you do financial planning for marine conservation. Some of the other hats that I wear, I also am the chief executive officer for Reef Check Australia. Reef Check is an international nonprofit, and they've got a division in Australia. And they were interested in these ideas and have brought me on board to develop some of these ideas into action for that NGO.
That's great. So what does that development look like for Reef Check? I mean, what would you do to apply these principles to the nonprofit?
So Reef Check is, like many other nonprofits, based on, they get funding from government grants and from community membership donations. And they do really important work, but are always very tight on finances and always Sure. planning a few weeks ahead of time as to where the next dollar is going to come from. So for Reef Check, we are looking at developing social enterprises that could fund the science that the organization is was built to do, but through ways that don't rely on grants. And I have to say, stay tuned to see how that develops.
Excellent. So now you're sort of on the tail end finishing your
Yes.
degree. What's next for you?
What's next for me? I am trying to find ways to keep this work moving forward, and there are so many opportunities. One of the projects, one case study that I didn't speak about yet, was developing a loan fund for sustainable agriculture. I'm hoping to take that forward and make that into reality, and to continue doing some of the trainings and consulting that I've been doing to help NGOs and governments do better financial planning for their marine goals.
So interesting with the loan fund, it kind of reminds me of, there's been a lot of trend towards doing crowdsourcing for funding mm-hmm. research. Does that play into your work at all, or do you have any thoughts on the crowdsourcing research wave?
I think crowdsourcing is on the up, it's on the increase. It used to be that it could only be used for very charismatic species or things that got the public really riled up, like dolphins. There's a trend now that it can be used to fund all sorts of research and conservation activities. But when you look at the return on investment, it takes a lot of time to market those kinds of programs and to find people to do that. And so I'd say it can be a valuable component of an otherwise diversified funding portfolio, but I wouldn't rely on it as your only source of income.
Excellent. Now, I have to ask, since it's been a while since you've been in Hawaii, have you been able to get in the water yet?
That's happening right after the show, Carly. Thank you.
And working in the Barrier Reef, do you see similarities or differences in how the corals are managed here versus Australia?
Oh, it's fascinating. I think when one of the roles that I had in Hawaii was I worked at the Division of Aquatic Resources, and we were able to learn a lot from the Australian government management of the Great Barrier Reef, which is the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park. So I had sort of an external opinion of, they were sometimes called the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority is sometimes called the best management in the world. And so I got the privilege to go work over there, and I saw from the inside that they really do have some very sophisticated, elegant systems in place. They have some really smart people working on it, but they share a lot of the challenges that Hawaii does, and some of those common themes of trying to get people from different walks of life to agree on a plan, fishermen and commercial operators, and some of those challenges are the same no matter where you go. One of the big differences is that the reefs here in Hawaii are so accessible. They're right offshore, which means that it's very tangible for people. They rely on the reefs for their food and for their everyday activities, whereas the Great Barrier Reef is hard to get to. It's hours offshore by boat, and it's expensive. So there's a bit of a difference when you look at the community values of the reefs, but some of the challenges for managing it remain the same.
Interesting. It makes a lot of sense to me. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us. I'm really
My
excited
pleasure.
To talk a little bit more with you about this. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to actually talk with Patrick McGowan about coral conservation. But stay tuned, because I want to bring you guys back together and chat a little bit more about marine conservation. We'll be right back.
Good news from Dynavite. New Nomo Flea flea and tick spray kills fleas and ticks with no poison. New Nomo Flea is totally safe for dogs, cats, puppies, kittens, kids, babies crawling on the carpet, and even you. Because it's made from vegetable oil. Nomo Flea dissolves the hard shell of a flea or tick on contact, so the moist insides of that flea or tick just dry up.
No fleas.
No more flea instantly. No more ticks soon thereafter. Best of all, no more poison ever. So as of today, you can stop using imidacloprid, moxidectin, pyrethrin, and all those other flea and tick poisons. Get all the grisly nitty-gritty about fleas and ticks, or before your beloved pet ventures out in the backyard again, order a 30 or 60-day supply of new Nomo Flea. Just click the pic of the dead flea on Dynavite.com.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
A message from DAV to returning veterans. Thank you for doing your duty and doing our bidding. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way and putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for defending our freedom and displaying your honor. DAV thanks all veterans by fighting to get them the benefits and support they were promised. Visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. With us now is Petra McGowan, Reef Resilience Program Manager for the Nature Conservancy, also known as TNC. The Nature Conservancy is a leading conservation organization working around the world and has protected nearly 120 million acres worldwide. So with that, welcome to the show, Petra.
Thanks, Carly. And I apologize, I have a little cold today.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a little bit of a hoarse voice, but we will work through that. That's not a problem at all. We're just so happy to have you here. I know you recently just flew in from Seattle and spending some time here and working for TNC. Tell me a little bit more about TNC.
Sure. The Nature Conservancy, our mission is to protect the lands and waters on which life depends. And We work around the world in over 35 countries directly, but we reach far many more because we partner with a lot of organizations, and the program that I'm going to talk about today actually builds capacity worldwide through trainings in countries where we don't necessarily have direct chapter work happening.
Excellent. And that program is the Reef Resilience Program, right?
That's right.
So how did that program come about?
Well, it's a 10-year-old program, so we're celebrating 10 years this year, actually.
Congratulations.
And the program was started by Rod Salm, who actually lives here in Honolulu. He is an amazing conservationist and scientist who noticed, you know, reefs bleaching 10 years ago, especially in 1998 when there was big bleaching in Palau. And he also noticed that there were areas where reefs recovered, and he wanted to figure out why, and there were other people working on this as well. And Rod really was one of the first to put together a lot of this information and make it accessible to managers. And that was the goal. Like, how do managers manage for bleaching originally? And what could they do to design managed areas to support that kind of resilience that we saw happen in Palau? And so this program's evolved to have a lot of different components to it, but that's how it started originally.
Wow, it's amazing to think 10 years ago that that was an issue and something that's been in the forefront of the news even today. I mean, we've had major bleaching here in Hawaii this year. Yeah. How has the Reef Resilience Program responded to that, if at all?
Well, yeah, let me clarify. The Reef Resilience Program doesn't actually, we don't implement direct programs on the ground. We build capacity of managers who are maybe responsible for responding to those bleaching events. And so the things that we've done is we have a network of marine managers around the world. And I view one of our primary jobs is to help them share lessons learned. So for example, Hawaii was one of the first places to have a really robust bleaching response plan that actually we wrote at DAR. Mm-hmm. And so that plan and how they've responded to last year's bleaching and current bleaching events is actually a model for a lot of places. And so Ann Rosinski from DAR has done a webinar with us for our network. We're sharing those lessons with other managers. In Florida, they actually have really strong disturbance response monitoring and bleaching response as well. So we just had a webinar last week where Mark Eakin from NOAA talks about what do the bleaching predictions mean for different regions. And then we always showcase a case study of actual management happening so that managers can see what are their options.
That's so amazing because you don't often hear about support for managers and people working together to share the lessons learned and not reinventing the wheel. So what are some of the managers around the world or in your program, how are they responding to these bleaching events? Have they been talking about that at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge issue right now. And bleaching is a tough one. I mean, as a former manager myself, bleaching is so hard because there is not necessarily a ton that you sometimes can do at the time due to the management structure in a lot of places. And what I mean by that is that bleaching, really, the best things we can do are reduce stresses to reefs in the time of a bleaching, mm-hmm. pre, post, and during. But most places that I am familiar with, the management structure doesn't really allow for quick adaptive management. And so, for instance, DAR can't quickly close an area off to tourism, even though that would help from what we know. And this is a huge problem. So I actually, it's one of my biggest struggles as somebody trying to support managers in bleaching specifically, because I want to give them more tools. And so what we've done so far, actually, I think, which is a really interesting focus, is managers are realizing how important it is to prepare their communications early. If they can have communications prepared and use it as a way to get people's attention, and that means a whole communications planning component to their plans, which often was an afterthought. So I think that that is something we're really seeing managers kind of grab onto, and obviously having strong monitoring so they can report what's happening.
Well, I may be biased, but I think the communications is a very important aspect of management and conservation. So you talk about offering these tools and the toolkits of sharing. Mm-hmm. What are some of those tools that you do share with the managers?
Sure. So the Reef Resilience Toolkit is an online hub, and it's at www.reefresilience.org. I encourage managers to check it out. There's a lot on there, and we try to make it easy to navigate. But one of the main components of it are these modules on with the latest coral reef and now a new fisheries module, science. So what I found as a manager is that there's so much science out there and I didn't have time to go through it all and stay on top of it. And so actually my team, our team helps really digest, translate, keep a pulse on what is the new science and how can it be applied. And we actually make it easier to find. So we have an accessible journal database. We have case studies from over 40 countries where we've really tried to see what's working in management. We make it a short case study with resources and places they can go for more information. And then, like I said, the actual pages on the toolkit, which is like, if you want to know something about coral reefs, there's a lot of information, but in a, I think, pretty user-friendly way.
Making it digestible is such an important piece of it. And is this targeted in certain areas? Or, I mean, you mentioned Hawaii and Palau and Florida. Do you work on a global scale?
Yeah. Our primary user that I consider is our coral reef managers worldwide. And so we're really trying to provide information that's useful around the world. That's challenging, obviously, because each region has specific issues. And one of the ways that we tackle that is by partnering with existing networks in different regions. So, for instance, we have a partnership with the Indian Ocean Commission that supports coral reef managers in the Indian Ocean. And I use that network to figure out priorities jointly so that we're really grounding the things that we're offering with our regional networks, the same in the Caribbean, the same in Southeast Asia. So that's the main technique. We try to offer something a little different than like a local network, because often it's hard when you're just supporting managers in your own region to get your head up and look around. And so we try to help all of them communicate to each other. We do that partly through doing exchanges as well, so bringing managers from different places together to learn from each other.
Excellent. And it sounds like you work with such a diverse group of people all across the world. Is there a particular group that is the most receptive to what you're doing? I mean, is it regional, or is it, federal government partner managers, or is it more local grassroots managers?
So I would say, what is the definition of a coral reef manager? I mean, I think we can't assume we're all talking about the same thing, right?
Right.
And so for us, a manager is anybody who has management responsibility, and most of the time legally recognized, but in some places maybe they're struggling for those rights, and they would still be considered somebody that I would be reaching out to with the network. So for instance, here in Hawaii, there's a lot of communities in the process of trying to get rules passed so that they can actually have management authority again. So those community members would be, in my mind, a manager. But also the state of Hawaii resource managers are definitely a primary target audience for us. And I would say across the board, anybody who's responsible or feels a sense of responsibility to managing reefs has been receptive to this information, because often reef managers are very isolated. In many places we work, they don't have any support. And it is a tiring job, to be honest. I mean, it can be draining when you have a lot of stakeholders always very frustrated. You know, marine management is contentious. And I speak from experience that it can be a tiring job. And I find one of the most critical things that we do is bringing managers together so they can remember why they do their work and continue to be inspired and keep at it.
So it can be contentious, and I appreciate you speaking frankly about that. Is there, can you think of a story or a moment in the work that you've done where you've really seen a difference or a reward from what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I see rewards all the time, because one of the components of our program, when we do an in-person training, when possible, I also generate funds for small seed funding. Then they can actually sometimes implement some of the things that we're learning in the training if their agency doesn't have the resources to do that. And I am constantly hearing backstories from network members about something they learned, and they went back and applied it differently to their job, and they felt like really good about what happened, even if it's just how they communicate with the community, and then they approached it in a different way because of the training. and now they're working incrementally toward their outcome. You know, I know everybody wants to hear that perfect story where your manager got trained and they went back and they created a marine protected area or they passed a rule. That just, coral reef management is slow.
Yeah.
It's slow, it's incremental, and no matter how many times people ask me for that perfect story, I'm going to say it's actually the small victories that are most inspiring to me, and knowing that they feel supported.
But a lot of small victories can be equally or more rewarding than one large one, so that's great to hear. And you mentioned earlier that you have a new fisheries model as well, so not just reefs. What was the impetus behind expanding to fisheries?
Well, I mean, when I talk about reefs, and this is another assumption, reefs are complex. The fish are as much a part of the reef as anything else. And so for us, it's not just about coral, but fish are a key, it's what is at the top of mind of most stakeholders, and most resource managers are dealing with fisheries issues. And so we needed to give them more tools, especially in coral reef fisheries, which are also kind of known as data limited stocks. There's not a lot of data out there for managers to do their management with. And so the attempt at trying to get some new resources together to help managers in these data poor stocks approach their work in a different way.
So it sounds like you guys are doing a great job of integrating some of that science into the management. Do you have a lot of scientists that you work with as well?
Yeah. Thanks for asking that question, because I think I haven't stressed that enough. The science link and the experts, which I'll call mentors, actually, they are the other half of our network. It's about connecting managers on the ground who are often isolated and maybe not supported with new science to actually have direct access to scientists working on this stuff. And we do that through in-person trainings where we actually bring these experts in to teach, but also we do a mentored online course. So it's very expensive to run an in-person training. And so one of the tools we're working, we've done it for 5 years now, and I would say it gets very high, you know, support from the managers that have taken it and recommendations for their colleagues. We do these online self-paced courses, and the managers can go through the lessons, but then there's a forum where they can actually go ask an expert different questions, and the expert will answer their questions. So all of our material on the toolkit, when those modules that I talked about, we create those, but they are created in partnership with experts around the world who review and help us keep that content up to date. So the science link is critical.
Yeah. And so they have an option of doing an online course or an in-person training. Do they benefit each other? Can you do both, or do you just do one?
Yeah. We're experimenting with different things. Initially, when the online course was launched, we paired it with an in-person training. So prior to the in-person training, you would do a four-month course where you'd go through a whole bunch of curriculum, interact with experts, and then come together for a week. But we're just finding that there's more demand out there, and so we actually are going, we have the self-paced courses all the time. I mean, over 1,500 people have just taken it on their own. That's happening organically, but actually courses that we're advertising and providing mentors for is, you know, takes more time and capacity. But this year we'll be actually planning to host a couple different versions of our online course, smaller versions. So right now the full course is almost like 4 months with mentors.
Wow.
We give managers time because we know they're doing this on top of their jobs.
Yeah.
But we're going to run some specific topic sessions. So on resilience assessments and stuff like that. So those are some new approaches. We're always trying new things to try to figure out what works.
Sounds like you guys are right on top of it. That's fantastic. So I'm so curious about these trainings. Can you walk us through what a training would look like, a typical training that you would do?
Sure. So there's two types of trainings. I mean, sometimes we're bringing managers from a whole region together. So some of the goals of those trainings are actually making sure they have time to connect to each other. It's not just about get them information. So usually we'll have actually quite a lot of time for them to just over dinner talk about their work and their experiences. But usually the curriculum would be structured around one or two key topics that we have identified from a needs assessment that we do in that region. So every time we're about to go somewhere, we have this long-standing network, so we'll use that network to ground truth the needs. And then we'll also reach out to, like I said, key partners in the region and say, what do you think the key topics should be? And we'll do 2 to 3 days on that new science. And we'll also spend at least 2 days or more on communication and facilitation skills. And this is something that our program's been doing for over 5 years. And a lot of times managers say, why am I doing this? And then when they leave the week at the end, it's the thing that they found most valuable. Because managers who work in marine spaces are constantly managing meetings and stakeholders, sure. And often they're never given training in communication or facilitation.
So are these trainings that you do in one specific location with a group of people, or do you bring managers from all over the world together to sort of cross-pollinate in an international platform?
Yeah, so like that. We'll host a training in Zanzibar, and we'll bring managers from 10 countries around that region. Or we'll host a training just in June. We did a regional training for the Caribbean in Puerto Rico, and we had managers from 10 different countries there.
Wow.
But we also partner with NOAA's Coral Reef Conservation Program to support domestic work. Mm-hmm. And that work is really targeted at the U.S. coral reef jurisdictions. And so in this past year, we've run a series of strategic communications workshops for outreach staff within the management agencies. And those have been really focused on just a smaller group of countries, well, states and territories, and more spots for managers in those places.
Sure. Oh, that's fantastic. It sounds like you guys are covering a lot of ground. Do you do any work in Hawaii?
Yeah, I'm lucky to get to come to Hawaii quite often because it's a pretty central place when you're trying to bring managers together from the territories.
Mm-hmm.
We offer quite a few trainings here just because it's worked out location-wise. And for me, that's wonderful having worked here before.
And what advice would you give to others who want to, maybe not managers, but who want to know more about reef resilience or this program?
Well, definitely check out the website because there's an introductory online course there. It's all free, and that's a really good course just for general public about what is resilience and some examples of what managers are doing. We actually have a case study from Kahikili because that is a really great example to see how the state of Hawaii has been trying to recover herbivore populations and address their reef health issues. So there's actual video on there. And so I would suggest taking the introductory online course and checking out the toolkit because there's a lot of information just general about it. And I think that's the place to go.
Excellent. Well, that's good. I will definitely direct people to that website. And is there anything individuals can do to help make our reefs more resilient?
Yeah, I mean, it's really about addressing those key stressors to reefs. And that is something we're all contributing to on a daily basis. It's how our places deal with land-based pollution. Are our fishing rules sustainable? Are they supporting healthy fish populations? And also climate. I mean, we haven't talked about climate, but resilience is really a two-part thing. I mean, I believe there's a space for managers and we need to be helping them do the best job they can. But if we can't get emissions under control, their job is made so much more difficult. So as a public stakeholder, we need to care about climate change and then we need to deal with our everyday impact on reefs. And those are the main things that we can do. I know people hear a lot of those messages, but it is about every little thing you do and how it is supporting or not overall sustainability of reefs.
Absolutely. Now, I know there's going to be a big coral reef conference here in Hawaii this summer, the International Coral Reef Symposium. Will you be offering any trainings or doing any work with that conference?
Yeah, for sure. We're actually hosting a couple sessions with some partners. It's still being all fleshed out, so I'm not going to really actually say what they're called or anything.
Sure.
But yeah, we'll be doing some sessions on networking, I think. We have a lot of tools that we've learned over the life of the program because we do use so many online resources that we really try to share with other people if they're thinking of moving into that space. And we're also going to be there. There's another conference as well in the later in the summer, I believe, the World Conservation Congress, and there's a whole training component to that conference, so we're actually going to be offering some trainings with that conference as well.
Hawaii's going to be crazy with marine conservation conferences this summer, really big ones too.
It's
so
true.
I that speaks, I think, to Hawaii too and all the great work we're doing. What wonderful platform for us to showcase all the work. All right. Well, thank you so much, Petra. You've been an amazing resource to talk to here. And stay tuned because we're going to bring Melissa and Petra back to talk more about marine conservation after a quick break.
Do shopping online and using public Wi-Fi make you vulnerable to identity theft? Does giving out your social security number put you at risk? Is your dog at risk of identity theft? Yes, yes, and no. Your dog has absolutely nothing to worry about. But we do live in a world that can expose a lot of personal information, and that can lead to having your identity stolen and losing everything you've worked for. That's why at LifeLock we use proprietary technology to detect a wide variety of threats. And unlike free credit monitoring services, we have a dedicated U.S.-based staff to help restore your identity if it ever is compromised. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But if you ask yourself whether you're worth protecting with the best, isn't the answer a resounding yes? Plans start at $9.99 a month, and now you can get 10% off. Go to LifeLock.com and use promo code NEWS.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home, should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and now we have both Melissa Walsh and Petra McGowan with us talking about reef resilience and marine conservation. So ladies, you've both talked a lot about some really interesting concepts regarding marine conservation pertaining to coral reefs. I want to get a little bit more into depth with some of the topics that we shared over the last couple sessions. So the term adaptive management came up, and I think what you both do is really related to this and how managers can adapt, because let's face it, what our coral management is having to face now is not what they had to face 30 years ago. So in your experience, what do you see as being the most positive way to adapt to our changing climate and changing reef areas?
I could address that from the finance point of view, mm-hmm. and I think Petra can speak better to some other aspects. But when I look at adaptive management, a couple things come to mind. First of all, when people think about funding for coral reefs, they often use the phrase sustainable funding. And I am guilty of this in the past, and I am on a mission to teach people to not say sustainable funding, because there's no such thing as sustainable funding. There's no threshold of money after which you have enough and you can do all that you need to do. We need to do financial planning to be prepared to adapt. And what that means is we need investors and pockets of money that can be ready for situations like Petra mentioned, where there we need a rapid response and you need some funding in place to be able to divert to that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes funding gets locked in and you might have money but you can't use it for what you really need. So we need to make sure there's some flexible, rapidly accessible funds so that managers can respond to changing circumstances. And for me, it also is about adaptation. There are a lot of concerns out there about using private money for coral reef management. And perhaps in the past, there were some good reasons for that. But like everything else, we need to adapt. There's not enough government or philanthropic money in the world to save coral reefs. We have to adapt, and we need to find ways to use private capital in a more a smart and effective way. And my experience has been that there are risks to using private money, but there are also scaffolds and boundaries you can put in place there are processes that you can do to minimize risks, and we need to be less scared of going there and more willing to have transparent, open conversations with our communities about how to do it effectively and adapt to changing situations.
Sure. I think that the future is definitely pointing towards that direction.
Yeah, I agree, especially about the point about the money for incidents of bleaching. You know, the contingency funds have been a huge issue for managers. They might put it in a grant that they have, but then the grant runs out and they didn't have a bleaching that year. But it's a continual issue for them to secure these kind of funds where they can actually respond to new and emerging issues for reefs and the ones that we know are unpredictable. But I also want to add, when I was thinking of adaptive management, I was really thinking of some of the, and I don't have a perfect answer because I think it's a big issue, that is the actual process we have for making our rules, and changing them is not adaptive. And so, for instance, if the state of Hawaii designates a series of small protected areas that they believe are going to help the resilience of all Hawaiian reefs, if they learn something new, chances are they have to go through a 10-month to a 2-year process to change that. And they would jeopardize a lot of work that could have, you know, getting anything passed is such a challenge. It makes there a lot of hesitancy, I think, on the part of managers to re-enter a process that they might have finally completed after 10 years of work. So the system is not set up, in my mind, permitting and rulemaking is not set up in the majority of places to actually allow managers to be adaptive. And I don't have a good answer, but it's a huge problem with the issues of climate change.
And there are so many issues to look at, but I do agree with you both there. And, you know, in the past you heard a lot, too, about this big divide between science and management. And it seems like that conversation has quieted down a bit. And I wondered, is that because scientists and managers are talking more together now and it is a little bit more adaptive and working together? Or is it just not on the radar of conversation anymore?
I have some strong thoughts on that one. I think it's definitely better than it was 10 years ago when I started in the field. I think there's way more communication between scientists and managers. I also think part of that was because it was starting to be required by funders, and they're saying to people, you want to do something new in science? What's your application to management? Have you talked to a manager? And I think those are all really positive things, but I also still think sometimes I'm involved in a lot of times people saying, well, here's some science and I'm going to engage a manager, but the actual type of engagement is not as deep as I would like to see. I think sometimes they say, and we're going to share it with management, and that is not at all sufficient. Like, just writing your paper and sharing it through our network even has to be more substantial.
Absolutely.
I'd agree with you, Petra. I think in my experience it's gotten better, but it still has a long way to go. And there is a lot of this token consultation back and forth and frustration on both sides of scientists saying, well, managers aren't using my work, and managers saying, the scientists aren't doing anything that I can use. And so I think it needs to go beyond the project level consultation to be more strategic and programmatic to say, this is the types of science that we need to change how we manage. And science for adaptive management, I think, is a key area for the future, because as Petra was talking about, there is a need to change whole systems so we can be more adaptive. And we don't have a lot of science to support that. There are some decision science programs looking at that. In my experience in Australia, there is this real concern that if a scientist works closely with a manager, it might bias their results. So in a lot of ways, I think Hawaii might be ahead.
Oh, excellent. And I was going to ask, is there any examples that you can think of where science and management is working really well together?
Oh, putting me on the spot. No, I mean, I'm trying to think right now off the top of my head. I mean, I would just say in general, I see it a lot more, obviously, in every science. And just the example I'd point to is just the willingness we have for really amazing scientists to work with our network for free. I'm not paying them. This is huge. These people are busy and they are amazing and their time is precious. And they are going on there and answering questions for managers in their time. And they are coming to trainings basically with me just paying travel time. This is a huge, huge thing. And there's more experts, I think, willing to engage with managers than actually our team has the capacity to process. Because because it's actually the issue we have is managers, they want to be involved, but there's some issues there trying to get them to feel comfortable to talk to experts. And so we have a lot more experts saying, Petra, how can I help? Then some, I'm actually saying to them, okay, you know, I'll bring you in when we can. Right now we have a full docket of experts. So
interesting. And before we wrap up today too, you know, I have to divert the conversation a little bit and acknowledge the fact that I know both of you from Division of Aquatic Resources and working with the state here in Hawaii, and I think it's amazing to see all these fantastic programs and people that started out with this, with the Coral Reef Local Action Strategy program, that have grown from this. Is there something about the program, or what was the experience or take home that you got working for the state at Division of Aquatic Resources that you now apply to what you're doing?
Oh, look, it was a fantastic program and experience for me, and certainly helped me to get going in the direction that I've headed. And I think some of the aspects of it are that being in an island situation, where everything is interconnected, all the people in the programs, you sort of get a start at working across many issues, where, you know, I had the opportunity to have a little bit of involvement in coral bleaching and land-based pollution and fisheries and this and this and this, and so getting to be across several issues, that's not an opportunity that many people starting out in coral reef management get. Often you start in a big location and you get to do a tiny piece of the puzzle. So for me, that was really important. And the chance to work in a government agency that recognized the importance of talking to community and community-based management, I felt really fortunate to have those experiences that I've been able to take and work in other places with that sort of attitude that it really has to be a partnership and communities need to be actively participating in management.
Sure.
Yeah, same. So many lessons. I agree that having a chance to be involved in so many different issues is really a great experience and really broadens your perspective on reef management and how to tackle those issues. You see that it's definitely not going to be done by just DAR. It's critical that those partnerships exist. And but I guess I would say for me, the big take home, since my career right now is about manager support, is what it was like to really be a manager. And I keep that in mind every day as I do our program work.
Well, thank you, ladies. And Melissa, I'm just going to correct you. You forgot to also include recreational impacts.
Thanks, Carly.
Anyways, Petra, Melissa, thank you so much for taking some time to be here today. I want to also acknowledge and thank our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Kosi Island Earth. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy your ocean planet.